Good afternoon. Today is February 8th, and welcome to the Senate Judiciary. It is Monday, and it has been kind of a manic Monday, I think. Today with us is Vice Chair Senator Schauer. We've got Senator Keel, Senator Myers, and Senator Hughes. We have Nancy Hemingway, and we've got Alex with us again. You guys have been doing an excellent job, by the way. Today, we are going to be having a conversation about liability. And is the state liable for several different things in regards to the disaster declarations and the extent it, and we wanted to get a vaccine liability as well on here today. We may be able to touch that, and we're going to get to some people from Department of Administration in a few minutes. But right now, we're going to go swiftly into the agenda, and we have Scott Jordan, Division of Risk Management for the Department of Administration. And so I'm going to do a sound test. Scott, can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
Okay, excellent. Okay, so thank you for being with us today. As people know, I'm very concerned about, in the big picture, the disasters and the impacts that they've had and the collateral damage that has been across the state of Alaska. But in particular, the emergency youth authorization for vaccines is something that has definitely been of concern. And informed consent, and it opens the state up, we believe, for potential liability if informed consent is not given to those who are receiving the vaccinations. For example, Agent Orange was something that ended up causing our military a lot of harm, and it ended up creating a lot of issues at the federal level. So we have submitted several questions to you, and I certainly want to open up the floor as well to committee members. But I believe we have Commissioner Chewbacca on as well and Kelly Hanke. But, Scott, I don't know if you had any opening comments or if you just wanted us to go ahead and jump into some concerns, you know, in regards to risk management and liability to the state.
For the record, this is Scott Jordan. I'm the director of the Division of Risk Management, excuse me, for the Department of Administration. I don't have any open presentation. I'm just available for questions.
Okay, so with that, I'm going to start, and then if anybody wants to jump in, just kind of raise your hand. So I see, first of all, as you know, the mRNA vaccines are under emergency youth authorization only. So I wanted to say my goal in today's meeting is just to see if the state has risk or if this is even being looked into, even if a risk assessment is being done. We need reassurances that we have things taken care of. For example, if someone gets a vaccination and they didn't have informed consent, are you able to talk about that or not today, Scott?
I can address that question. And I think that's probably the only case where I could see that the state would be liable is if the state is administering vaccinations without an informed consent from the person receiving the vaccination.
Okay, because and thank you, because I asked this question, and because, as you know, the administration has a max vaccination plan, and I think I saw today that over 100,000 Alaskans have been vaccinated, and I think that excludes the military. They have been vaccinated with this new agent, the mRNA vaccination, which is under emergency youth authorization. So I looked it up, and it said if they didn't have informed consent, it could be grounds for misconduct. And I think that's one of the reasons why I wanted to open up this can of worms to see if the state does have liability. So with this, do you know if there's any precedent that can be used? Like, let's say somebody gets the vaccination and they didn't get informed consent. Do you know if there's any precedent that has been set in any previous cases? And I know these are questions you may or may not be able to answer, but do you know if there's any precedents that has been set where it could open up a big can of worms for a state liability?
Thank you, Chair Reinbold. I am not aware of any state cases that are like this.
Okay, and I have not done a legal research yet, but because there's a vaccination plan and there's unbelievable amount of information out there right now, pushing and pushing and pushing to get vaccinations. I just think that the state is involved at this point in time. And I'm not sure if you know if Health and Social Services, and you may not be able to answer this question, do you know if Health and Social Services is doing anything? Is there any type of assessment to ensure that they're requiring informed consent when these, this 100,000 or so people that have gotten this either Pfizer or Moderna, do you know if anybody is looking into it, seeing if they are actually requiring or ensuring that the patients are signing informed consent?
Again, Chair Reinbold, I'm not aware of what they're doing as far as informing folks of the vaccinations and the side effects.
Okay, so I'm feel free if anybody else has questions just to get my attention. So the impacts of the disaster have been pretty significant. The disaster, originally locked down the state, and we're trying to figure out, is the state liable for any of the impacts of that decision? For example, if a business went under because of the executive branch mandate, do you know who is liable for that?
Chairman Reinbold, I couldn't comment on who would be liable if there was some fallout, such as businesses shutting down or anything like that. I just couldn't comment on that.
Okay, I'm going to go ahead and go to Senator Shaw right now.
So, question, Scott, on this one. To maybe dig slightly deeper into Senator Reinbold's question, because it's actually something we debated last year but was not put into the provision of the Bill 241 that passed. And that was, what are we setting the state up for here with some of these mandates and other things that happen? The concern being kind of twofold, and I know you may not be able to comment, but if you could expand, it would be helpful, just maybe even from an opinion perspective, and I know that's tenuous for you. But one of the things is, of course, the mandates, and then you go to home rule cities like Anchorage, for example, that went further, more restrictive, which they're allowed to do, not less than the administration mandates. But you had businesses that, as we are well aware, hundreds have gone out of business. They're not coming back. I mean, Juneau is in other southeast towns right now are under the same problem with what happened with the Canada shutting down the cruise ship industry. They're at great risk because of these policies. And so the question becomes, is it something that, even though you're not aware of it and don't want to comment on it or maybe not able to, is when a business is forced to shut down by direct action of the governor? We had a expert here that testified last week that said due process, the 14th Amendment, was the absolute thing we should be looking at, because we are causing businesses to go out of business, not of their own, but because of what we're forcing them to do, and there was little to no due process, allegedly, right, because we're talking legal, and that seems to be in an area, if the state is violating due process rights of citizens to own a business and do their, to do their business, that we're putting ourselves at risk. And I know this is kind of a long question, but I'm trying to drill down a little deeper, because it seems to me that we maybe haven't seen court cases, or maybe they're being considered, that a business owner could legitimately say, excuse me, their rights have been violated, in which case, who do you point to in that case? And you can't point to business conditions, you can't point to the decisions a business owner make. You can point to what, for example, the city of Anchorage decided to do, or perhaps what the state of Alaska decided to do that forced their business basically to go under. And I have examples I provided last week where I talked about, I have business owners that were threatened by the state, by state workers. For example, bar owners that were threatened that their license would be pulled if they opened and saw anything outside of what they demanded. And they told me flat out they couldn't operate at 25%, they were going to go under. But if they operated more than that, they had state workers show up and tell them, if you do that, we're going to pull your license and they're done. So it's direct action of the state and municipalities that are causing some of these things. So it seems like we are setting ourselves up for risk of being sued and being held liable. And the second part of it is, as an administration and as a legislature, should we not have passed, because we asked the question, it didn't happen, some type of provision where business owners can't be held liable? Because the concern is, when you do some of these things, now a lawyer that wants to come in and make a name for themselves or whatever it might be is able to come in and say, hey, this person caught COVID in your business, you're liable, we're going to sue you. And we've given them no protection for that I'm aware of. So kind of a two-pronged question, Senator Reinbold, but these really dig down into issues I know the legislature is concerned about because we've discussed them. Thank you.
Yeah, to answer your question through the chair, you know, for risk management operates like an insurance company, and I'm not sure everyone's aware of that, but we don't make a liability determination. Obviously, liability determinations would be made by the courts, if you will. So to answer your question and probably answer both pieces, I mean, some sort of liability would have to be determined or made by the courts if it got to that point. And then yes, the state has self-insurance for liability. So we would be, you know, if it was determined that we were liable, then we have insurance that covers that liability. And hopefully that addressed both of your two-prong question there.
Okay, so why don't you describe exactly, you're the Director of Risk Management, Department of Administration. We also have Kelly Hankey, the legislative liaison on, and Commissioner Chewbacca online. So why don't you go ahead and what kind of direction do you give in regards to risk management? Do you want to just give an overall assessment of what you all do, your mission statement?
Senator Chairman Reinbold, are you asking what kind of direction we give to state agencies?
Just in general, your mission statement under your direction.
Well, okay. Our mission statement is to protect the assets of the state, and so that's done through several different avenues. Typically, we think of insurance as liability or property damage. We have aviation, marine coverage, and workers' comp. In the case of a liability claim, there are certain situations where we know we're going to be held liable, so we accept liability for those cases, and we may pay a claim. In cases where we don't know whether we would be found liable, those end up going to the courts, and the court makes the decision whether that's through a jury, makes the decision as to whether the state or a party is found liable. And if we are found liable, we do have, like I said, policies that cover the state for that liability.
Okay. Next, we're going to go to Senator Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Madam Chair, along the same line to Mr. Jordan, I think some of the issues that have been raised so far kind of go to the general scope of what state employees can and can't do that raises some of those liability issues for you. Could you speak, and I'm not going to ask you to lawyer, I'm only going to ask you to talk about from your perspective as a risk manager. What sorts of things would a state employee do that would keep you up at night with regard to the state liability versus things that a state employee might do? And again, I'm talking about the enforcement actions that Senator Schauer was talking about. So things that might keep you up at night from the state's liability perspective versus the sorts of actions that wouldn't particularly cause you much worry if you got a complaint.
Through the chair to Senator Keel, that's a loaded question, but I think that the general answer is things that would keep me up at night are things that are negligent acts by state employees or state agencies. Things that you know we know are wrong or wrongdoing. Those are things that would keep me up at night. You know, there are certain activities, such as road clearing, for instance, is a prime example that gets carried out every day, and there's a lot of claims that get generated out of road maintenance that we don't consider liability. Potholes is a great example. Those are just acts of God, and we go out and fix those potholes as soon as we can. But the fact that they're on the roads aren't necessarily a negligent act of the state of Alaska. So hopefully that answers your question.
Madam Chair.
Follow through, please.
Thank you. You know, it's very helpful, Mr. Jordan. On that, actually, there's a claim from a constituent of mine. I'm still miffed that you guys got wrong, in my opinion, but you stuck by it, and I respect that, grumble, grumble, grumble. I guess the follow-up question would be, how does that extend then to claims that might come in against the state for enforcing regulations or policies? Is that something that your office looks at for how state employees go about that?
Through the chair again to Senator Keel, we wouldn't probably get involved with enforcement of regulations. Certainly we look at regulations and statutes and make sure that they're being followed if that's the issue at hand or if that's the claim at hand, but certainly we don't make those determinations. Those are made by either the agencies or their legal representatives.
I have another topic, so if you put me in the back of the line.
Sure.
Thank you.
Senator Schauer's next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So more directly in line with what Senator Keel was saying, but just taking it to a different tact, if, for example, I'm going to go back to the question I had, you had a business owner who, without having any apparent legal recourse here besides going to the courts, which, of course, costs money, and most of them are struggling to survive in the current environment, or many of them are, if you had state employees, since that's what I understand you're discussing liability, that were going around, and I'll use the word threaten, but take that lightly, not out of context. They're going around, and maybe they're doing their job, or maybe they're trying to enforce, but the business owners are being forced essentially to shut down without that due process. Is that something where you could see the state either, and I understand, like Senator Keel said, you're not a lawyer, not asking for legal advice, but the state could find itself liable for a violation of that due process. And that may be a big leap for you to do here. I understand that. But because I know that's happened, and I say that in the sense of many constituents have come to me as business owners with these issues, is that something where, because it's the state employees that are actually taking these actions, the state might find itself in some type of liability or legal response, if you will, if court cases are filed? In other words, just trying to figure out, again, are we at risk for things like that based on potentially a 14th Amendment argument? Thank you.
Through the chair to Senator Showers, again, a liability has to be some sort. Somebody has to make a determination of liability, and that's really not something our office does, and I think you guys understand that. But to answer your question, if a state employee was doing something that was within the course and scope of their work, but yet it was a negligent act, or they were giving bad information, then yes, I would say in that scenario, in a hypothetical scenario like that, that there could be a determination that there's liability, and we would have to have some sort of conversation on compensation.
Okay, so I'm going to drill down on a couple things. First of all, I want to echo off of what Senator Keel was talking about in regards to regulations in the disaster declarations and pursuing. There was 13 pages of suspended regulations. I think we found over 110 suspended regulations just in health and social services. And I personally was looking at them like, wow, I cannot believe that these regulations got suspended. I don't know if you can speak to this or not, but isn't there liability to the state if martial law, you're allowed to do things like that, which you can only do for 20 days. But if he chooses to do this over, a long period of time, wouldn't that pose some concern and risk to the state by, for example, the inability for a lawyer to come and meet somebody if they got put into API, for example, and they have a constitutional right to talk to an attorney, that if that's suspended, what, to me, that just seems like that could impose some risk to the state. And so with 111 of them, that would take a lot of time to look at all of them in just one department. To me, that's of concern, and I don't know if anybody's even looking at that, the risk assessment or potential liability to the state.
This is Commissioner Chewbacca. Hold on, Scott. So Kelly Chewbacca, Commissioner of the Department of Administration. Senator Reinbold, it's a good question, but for our department, we wouldn't be able to determine the level of risk. That liability risk factor to the state is just a question for another department. We can only assess the payout or what happens under the insurance policy once a determination of liability is made.
Okay, so with that, Commissioner, and thank you so much for joining us today. In regards to when you guys were given any direction with the regulations, I think I just saw a few with you guys. Was there anything in particular you wanted to talk about, the direction you were given in regards to regulations and suspension of regulation or laws under the COVID declarations?
Through the chair, when we were given the emergency orders were issued back in the beginning of COVID, the question was raised as to what would be most helpful for Alaskans in a time when we needed to protect people from being exposed to COVID or with respect to the DRB program, what would help them with getting prescriptions faster or would be in line with CDC guidance or health plan guidance. And so we made those proposals. That was how it worked. I think that's consistent with everything in the government. But that's not related to the insurance program that Scott oversees.
Okay. Yeah, some of this might, and please help keep us in the lane of the Department of Administration. I really wanted Health and Social Services too, because lots of people have questions like, what if they didn't have access or weren't aware, you know, like ivermectin or hydroxychloroquine or whatever were available. They're good medications for treating COVID, but that's totally outside of your lane. I'm just wondering if anybody restricted, the Board of Pharmacy or anybody restricted access to those in any way. I'm not saying they did or didn't, but if they did or didn't, does that propose risk? Because they know, you know, with the data that it could save lives. Now they're giving this vaccination, you know, that is under emergency use authorization only. And we're just trying to figure out if there is liability in multiple different ways. One, because the state's purchasing them, administering them, pushing them, you know, oversees the program in any way. We're just trying to make sure that if there is adverse, somebody should be liable, in my opinion. I don't know if it's the manufacturer or what, but if there are adverse reactions, and in particular, if they weren't fully informed of the fact that this is not FDA approved, that it's under emergency use authorization, what does that do to the state? What kind of risk does that expose the state? And can any of you guys answer that question? I know you, Scott, you said something about, yes, if it could be misconduct. I said that. But it could be of concern, you stated at the very beginning of this presentation.
So this is, yes. Commissioner Chewbacca. Someone else would have to assess the liability to the state. Scott, what were you going to say?
I was just exactly the same thing as, you know, we'd have to determine that there is liability first, and then we would address that. And I think that's probably the kind of the underlying issue here is, you know, were they informed? Did they get a list of the side effects? That's probably the biggest issue, is to make sure that the people, at least that we're administering the vaccinations to, were informed and made an informed decision to take that vaccination.
Excellent, because I think that's really, really important, because I got an email today and they said they didn't sign anything, and so I think they needed it to be signed, you know. And I think I actually went to a doctor's office this weekend and got the packet for Moderna and Pfizer, and I know what they're doing in their office, but I don't know what all these other mass vax clinics are doing, and I just think it's super, super important. And I'm going to go to Senator Schauer next, and then we'll go to Senator Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So a question, I think, Commissioner, for you probably, and again, I'm going to continue to harp a little bit on this, because I am concerned about the liability the state may have set itself up for, and that could include the legislature in the sense of what we did or did not do to exclude the liability of business owners from being sued for somebody catching COVID. This has happened in a few places in the lower 48 we're aware of, where these types of accusations are being made, and they would, I think, quite easily be able to point to the state and go, well, not our fault. With the evidence we've already said, we're doing this, you know, based on the guidance we have been given. And if somebody makes that, and I'm asking for a little bit of a leap, I understand, but because you would have to make the payout of any liability, I guess my question becomes this, Commissioner, in more of your opinion, would it be prudent for the legislature and or the administration to make sure that we take that out of the equation so that we provide that type of, I guess, protection, maybe the best word, maybe not, for those that own businesses that are still operating, to exclude them from that type of liability? Because that, again, that I could see how this circles right back to the state, and you're not the appropriate department, but I'm asking more from a your opinion, from what you would see. Should we consider that still? I believe we should, to try to take that out of the equation. Does that make sense as a question?
Yes, through the chair. I understand your question, Senator. The answer is it's always good to reduce liability, so that's obvious. The decision on how to do that is best deferred to you all as policymakers. I think there's wisdom in considering what has incurred liability before. You look at what we've had as claims before in determining what makes that policy and what other states have incurred as claims before. I think what's unusual here is that this is unprecedented. So we don't know what's going to end up becoming our future court cases. Scott and I were just discussing claims that are just now coming forward from the H1N1 virus from several years ago. I think the same thing is going to be true of this. We don't know right now what's going to end up resulting in risk liability for the state from this. So the answer is yes, it's good to reduce your liability. We don't know what's going to end up causing liability for the state from this one, because we've never gone through a global COVID-19 pandemic before.
Thank you.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess, Madam Chair, I think that the member before me lost me a little bit on how the state might be liable for claims against a private business. I don't know if we're going to circle back on that. That one wasn't clear. But I did want to ask the commissioner, maybe Scott, about some of those state liability pieces with regard to, I know we talked a little bit about vaccinations. Scott, are you, or excuse me, I apologize, Madam Chair. Mr. Jordan, are you familiar with the federal PREP Act, the Public Readiness Emergency Preparedness Act, and its impact on liability for things like vaccine administration?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, I'm not familiar enough to speak about it, no. Hopefully that answers your question. I mean, I am aware there is a federal program, the Health Resources and Services Administration puts out a countermeasure injury compensation program, and I don't know if that's along the same lines as what you were speaking of, but this gives compensation to folks that have been vaccinated and may have issues with it.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess, Mr. Jordan, it's a remarkable piece of legislation, and when I read the descriptions of it, I think it took the very reasonable thing the commissioner said about how everyone always wants to reduce their liability, and took it to a remarkable, maybe even extreme level. I took the commissioner to mean nobody wants harms to happen, right? This act basically says unless someone responding to a pandemic is commits willful misconduct, and not by the usual standards of a preponderance of the evidence, but commits willful misconduct by, I think it was clear and convincing evidence, so one of the higher levels of civil proof, there just is no liability. I mean, there's just none. It's frankly bizarre, although perhaps it would make a risk manager sleep better at night. And so I wondered if risk management had the opportunity to look at how that act applies to things like vaccinations and vaccine distribution, the things the state is involved in.
Through the chair, Senator Keel, I have not, but I would be glad to review it and get back to the committee.
Thank you.
Okay, and with that, in regards to who would you recommend we talk to in regards to this? Would it be Department of Law? Are they actually the appropriate branch? Because I think it's really, really important that people understand when they're taking these these new mRNA under emergency authorization vaccinations, that basically we're trying to figure out who is liable. Is the state liable? Is the manufacturer? I think they're probably protected. You know, it just, if there is something that goes wrong, people need to understand that the risk that they're putting themselves under. And so, first of all, what department? And second of all, I was going to ask, if there are adverse reactions, wouldn't that, if there's a lot of state employees getting vaccinations, wouldn't that, you know, increase premiums or something? You know, if there's a lot of negative activity in regards to taking the mRNA vaccine. If you can answer either one of those questions, that would be great.
Senator Reinbold, I think we can answer both. We'll each take one. I would recommend talking to the governor's ledge office for the first question, because I think there's probably a couple different offices that have different pieces of this, and they're going to know the right answers, whereas our department just really specializes in our little unique world. And then, Scott, why don't you take the one about the different Alaskans taking these different shots and talk about the special answer about it depends on who's administering the vaccine.
Through the chair or to the chair. When it comes to and I think this was your question, it comes to administering the vaccination, you know, really the liability is going to fall back to who's administering that vaccination. The state, of course, is going to be responsible for any of their employees administering, such as public health, and making sure that people are being informed on all aspects of the vaccination. So, and as far as, cost to the state, I don't know if you're referring to the state employees themselves or just in general the vaccinations to the state. So maybe clarify that.
Just basically, if someone does have a death or an adverse reaction, and even if it's, down the road, what kind of liability does the state have? And let's just assume 10% of the state employees get it. It probably is going to be higher than that. But, if there's even 1% of those people that have an adverse reaction, wouldn't that drive, because they're going to need health care, obviously, wouldn't that drive our premiums or our hurt our self-insurance in any way?
I think that's probably a question better answered by the commissioner or even retirement benefits, if I'm understanding what you're saying. We cover workers' comp coverage out of our office, but I don't think this is a workers' comp question necessarily.
And okay, so I'm going to, if someone is being told that they have to take this on grounds of employment, wouldn't that end up being a workers' comp issue?
Senator Reinbold, we're not mandating the vaccine as part of employment with the state right now. So what Director Jordan is saying is that if a state employee, like someone who works for HESS, administers the shot and something goes wrong, that potentially could come back to risk management's insurance program. If a private doctor or nurse administers a shot and something goes wrong, that is the insurance, the risk liability is on the private doctor or nurse, regardless of the state's messaging or liability that you're contemplating. All of the liability rests with that doctor or nurse. So then let's say that the doctor or nurse that's private is administering a shot to a state employee, then our health plan that I'm the administrator of, that picks up like the health costs of the state employee. And right now, we don't expect that our costs to the plan, our health plan, are going to be affected by the vaccine at this point. So it's kind of a multi-layered answer there.
Okay, and I'm going to get to Senator Schauer in just a minute, but my question is, for example, let's say Dr. Zink makes a statement, and she says that with this mRNA, synthetic vaccine, that herd immunity is better, it's better than natural immunity, and then all these people in Alaska jump on board and say, oh, this is going to give me better than natural immunity, which every doctor I've talked to has said the opposite. But she's saying that, to me, that is, you know, her statement is unsubstantiated. And would not the state be at risk because of statements that she's making, such as that, that are leading people to believe something that may or may not be true?
So, Senator Reinbold, the answer is, unless we have a court finding of liability, at this point in time, our insurance plan has told us that the private doctors or nurses are liable for anything that goes wrong with administering the shot. And so they're required to give full disclosure of the pros and cons and the risks of the shot, just like a state employee who administers a shot would be required to do so. That's where the liability rests right now. And if there's some court finding later along the lines of what you're saying, then that would come back to Scott's division to administer the payout of the insurance plan for.
I'll just put it on the record. I've been completely alarmed at many, many, many statements that she said that I've called doctors and asked them, and they're like, oh, heck no, that is not common knowledge in the medical community at all. A lot of the information that she's jumping to conclusions is inconclusive right now. So I actually think that her statements are of deep concern. But anyway, Senator Schauer.
Thank you. It's more of a comment, Madam Chair. Just previous couple speakers ago had asked how or was not sure of how it could be liable to the state. I'm bringing this up because it goes back to March of last year when we had discussed this in various groups about how we might prevent business owners from being held liable for somebody that wants to claim they caught COVID in their business. We were informed from varying legal opinions that it was possible if we did not set something into the legislation, this Bill 241 that was passed, to provide specific exemption from them based on health mandates, how they were going to operate, or if they decided to continue to operate, et cetera, in an environment where we had declared a pandemic, and so, you know, people go in there and they are at risk. So while I'm not trying to make a mountain out of a molehill, it's based on previous comments and legal opinions that we argued through last year. And I know that's not something you can specifically answer, but just to answer Senator Keel's question, why I'm asking that is because it did come up as discussion, and we had considered putting some type of exemption or liability protection, I'm not sure what the legal term would be to call it, in that bill to help those business owners operate, just as we have, for example, at the federal level, I guess their protein therapy, not so much of a vaccine or is what they're calling it now for Moderna and Pfizer, that they can't be sued if somebody takes their product and has a negative reaction. So that's all it was. But I want to be clear on that because it's something we've discussed and have been told it could be an issue. So I'm trying to figure out from a state perspective, would it come back to us? Is it something we would be on the hook for? Which is why I wonder if it sounds like it would not be unreasonable for us at least to consider something that would help protect the state from liability and or business owners. So thank you. I hope that makes sense.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I appreciate the latitude you've given for the interplay of ideas today. It's an interesting notion, and I'll have to go back to my files. I guess my concern would be, and with your permission, Madam Chair, I'll share the Congressional Research Service did, I think, a five-pager on the PREP Act. It dropped my jaw when I read just how broad the liability exemptions are that the federal government has granted. And it's pretty clear that they are preempting any state law to the contrary. In the example you gave, and we may have a difference on exactly what the safety level is and where the research is leading. In the example you gave, a doctor could make outright false statements about what is effective, as long as they did not engage in willful misconduct. I mean, it's pretty close to needing to say out loud, I plan to hurt you. They wouldn't be liable. They simply would not be under the federal law. And so my concern as we talk about what the state might do, we all want to make sure businesses have reasonable legal environment to operate in. But I don't think any of us would want to go to the level the federal government has here, Madam Chair. If it's got an emergency use authorization, if it is designed in almost any way to address COVID, absent willful misconduct, there simply is no liability under federal law. It's we sometimes use the phrase federal overreach, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm. So I'm gonna go ahead and banter with you a little bit. What do you suppose we should do? Let's just sadly say someone you know ended up dying right after COVID vaccine. What do you think the solution is?
Well, Madam Chair, I appreciate the back and forth. I think that's precisely my point, is that while the federal government has a separate injury compensation program for the pandemic, I think that this federal law takes the liability shield too far.
Mm-hmm. And so I think that is the purpose of this hearing today, is that if there are people across the state that end up either getting long-term damage, short-term damage, death, who can the people turn to? My heart always goes out to the people. Not big government, protecting big government, that's really not where my heart is. My heart is, how are you, Senator Keel, going to answer to your constituents that get impacted tomorrow, the next day, a year from now? I'm sorry, we didn't do anything. You know, I don't want that answer. And I think that's exactly what I'm trying to point out. Is there state liability? Is there federal liability? Is there liability because the state purchased the vaccinations? Because they had this, you know, we're bragging, you know, that we're administering these and we're pushing people hard. I know multiple people are emailing me telling me they're being intimidated multiple times to take these vaccinations. You know, and they're getting to the point where a lot of people are telling me that they're afraid they're not going to be able to keep their job, and they're not comfortable with these. One, the intimidation factor. Two, you know, the liability. Three, the fact that there are no long-term studies. And if you do look in the studies that happened back in 2002 and through 2005, roughly, for the other mRNA vaccines, the animals did fine with the first injection, fine with the second one. But then when they were exposed a year or so later, they died. And so that is where my concern is, and I'm not saying that's going to happen, and I hope to God that doesn't happen, but there could be some adverse things that do happen with this new experimental. Where's the liability? And that's all I'm trying to do, is flesh out either for the state or for the individual, you know, or for the people who are actually administering or purchasing or the manufacturer. I'm with you. I think the shield is way too strong, and that's why I'm trying to figure out what can we do for our people if something, God forbid, happens in a negative way. That's why I want to have this discussion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think it is, we're incredibly fortunate that these two mRNA vaccines have been so safe, that the animal studies that were done on them run at the same time as human studies because of the emergency. The animal studies that were done on them showed no harm to the animals and effective immune response against COVID-19, but the notion that we need to trust to every experiment being as safe, every attempt being as safe as we have proven these vaccines are, that worries me too. So as we go forward, I'm happy to work with you on petitioning the federal government to take a half step back for the sake of caution, because I think some level of liability, if bad things do happen with the next one, God forbid, is appropriate.
And I'm going to respond to this. There hasn't been that much time. I mean, these there's been like, what, 8 months or something, you know, between the time that they wanted them to be created and then the time that they were actually being dispersed. The animal trials with the first one, they actually died a year or two later. And so that's why it's too early right now. Is the verdict's not out, and that's my point right now. Is the verdict's not out? They have not had the. I know I used to work for pharmaceutical companies. The average was about 7 years for vaccines to be produced, sometimes 10. But it's just been a short period of time, and that's why I just want to be able to say we tried, we talked about this, we're trying to. You know, if God forbid anything negative does happen, you know, where can people go? And so, yes, I wouldn't say half a step back. I would take a few giant steps back, you know, the federal government. So I'm happy to work with anybody that's willing to on this issue. But I just want to make sure that the people know we're listening, that we are concerned, and that we're trying to see if there is going to be help for them if something negative happens. Because there's lots of questions I don't have that HESC won't come before us and actually answer. Like, what if someone had COVID and then had a vaccination? What happens? You know, what happens? I don't know. So I think really important things like that. Senator Schauer, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's strangely, again, I find that we have some strange same thoughts, you know, on folks with this again. But you're both saying things that you kind of already answered the question or the comment I wanted to make, but I'm going to say it because I think the amount of time is important because we don't know what's going to happen with these or others under emergency use authorization. It does take a long time for vaccines to come to trial where pharmaceutical companies, those that are in the business, you know, have been very clear on that before they're considered truly safe and they have the data they feel to back it up. I think we have to be very cautious as a body, ensuring the liability to the state, to our business owners and others, that we ensure that there are recourse actions for them depending on what happens. And I am concerned for the same reasons, just because of the amount of time. I understand the desire to get something out because of how this played out, but at the same time, you know, just allowing that lack of liability at all, where do we go with this next? What precedent are we setting for the next few years as this takes place? Because if we start seeing reactions a year later, then what? Where are you going to go? And who and how are we going to hold companies or others accountable that did this? So both of you are saying things I agree with, and I think it's important we find that blend as a state to make sure that we're taking care of our citizens, because it is a concern. I don't know who you would turn to right now, because it seems to be this blanket, hey, you know, no matter what happens, it's fine. It was because it was an emergency. Well, I can give you one quick example, and I'm done commenting, mm-hmm. but in 2016, I was briefed by a lab microbiologist that's working in one of the labs in Anchorage and told us in 2016 they had a similar thing, dengue fever, in Africa, and they vaccinated 1 million people. And the next year, almost all those million people died because it had mutated slightly and the vaccine was pointless. And they go, oh, well, nobody had anything down there. Who did they turn to? They're poor, that country. They got no help whatsoever. And I think that's germane for us to understand that, you know, hey, if we start seeing problems, how do we help our citizens, protect them, not only the state, but truly our citizens? And so I just have concerns. I think it's great we're having the discussion because we need to have some answers just in case. And so anyways, thank you for the discussion for both of you. I think we need to be very cautious about it, but the state should certainly be investigating in the legislature how we might provide that. Thank you.
And thank you, because I could have done a huge timeline of all the problems that vaccines have caused over the years, and then possibly, you know, to contradict that, you know, or to tell the other side of the story, you know, where there's been cases, lots of cases where they've been helpful in a society, but they're certainly out there. But the problem is I can't pinpoint who's liable if things go wrong right now. I just can't, no matter how far and how far I dig. And I think at the very minimum, that means I think we need to be extraordinarily cautious with you know, this whole, you know, getting people 100 million by in the first 100 days or something like that, because I can tell you, people are getting intimidated, bullied, multiple letters, phone calls, and it, they're starting to get where they're not comfortable. They're genuinely, and they're concerned that they're going to lose their job, and that's another thing where I think is a concern, liability issue. But right now, I was trying to just pinpoint on who is liable when a vaccine, and I think Commissioner Chewbacca basically said it's the person who actually injects in it. And is that really fair? I mean, honestly, I don't know if that's really fair. But anyway, Senator Myers, please.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out real quick that there's liability and then there's compensation. Mm-hmm. And I don't know about the liability side of things, but on the compensation side, there is a federal program that is involved in this. It's the Countermeasures Injury Compensation mm-hmm. Program. And it does put a very high bar as to mm-hmm. who can be compensated, but there is at least a program set up for compensation for people that may feel that they have been injured through the vaccine or through other medical measures associated with COVID.
And thank you for bringing that to the table. I am aware of that. It is an extremely high bar, and Dr. John Weiler spoke about this, and he actually said he was on that, and he was bribed, and there's a big video out there, I posted it, to try to change the answers to reduce liability with that. So it's like the fox protecting the hen house with a very, very high bar. So it gives the people a little bit of hope, but it doesn't give a whole lot of hope in regards to that. But I still think with this broad, you know, if we have over 100,000 people in Alaska, you know, I'm just hoping, you know, that good things happen, but I just think the verdict is not out yet. I know Johnson & Johnson is coming up with another one, and it's actually a real virus that's being put into it. It's not a synthesized virus. So, you know, that's a completely different issue, but that's definitely one that I'm trying to follow really hard right now, is the Johnson & Johnson one, and AstraZeneca as well. I don't want to hold you guys on too long, but just to get this on the record, I'm just concerned that the models that were used to declare the disaster, you know, those need to be plugged in at UAA. I'm going to try to see if the UAA will do that for us to see if they panned out because of the disaster. But if the disaster was not based on solid evidence where the model panned out, again, is there a risk? Because hundreds of businesses are struggling, if not thousands. And, you know, there's a lot of issues. There's a lot of collateral damage to what happened with these disaster declarations and the extensions of the disaster declarations. And so I think that we've got to make sure that it was based on solid, you know, solid foundation as well. So I don't think you guys want to comment in regards to that. But if the PCR tests are being done at too high of an amplification, you know, is that of concern? Oh, it certainly is of concern to me. Like, let's just say over 25, there can be, you know, if you amplify it over 25, there could be false positives or false negatives. That's of concern if the state is doing it at 38. I think that's another, because lives are being changed. I mean, people aren't getting to go to work. They're having to stay home. They're having to quarantine. Some people can't travel. It's impacting a lot of lives. So I think, you know, just having a conversation about the PCR, making sure that it's used appropriately. I know that LabCorp said that there was somebody got a letter that said that their antigen tests were 40% false negatives. So to me, that's of concern. You know, if there's a lot of false negatives or false positives, but yet lives are being transformed, we need to open that can of worms up. I think it's super, super important. And then I know you guys probably don't want to weigh in on this, but the liability, if people are being told to wear face masks, one saying it's going to protect them, you know, or the governor's making everybody do it in different state buildings, you know, or posting like we see them in our building. What if someone gets pleurisy? What if someone lots of people get pleurisy, secondary infections, styes in their eyes? I know I got my eye cut by wearing a mask, you know, when I was adjusting it. Asthma, acne, you know, all the secondary things that can happen from wearing masks. And then can you prove that they actually prevent the spread or even slow the spread based on what the average person is wearing, I think is highly suspect. We need to have this kind of discussion, especially when, you know, people are getting fined and things like that if they don't wear them. I think that is a super important. If Governor Dunleavy or his administration is pushing masks, we need to know if there's side effects to them. You know, who do we turn to? So with that, I'm going to see if anyone has any final questions. Does anyone have any final questions for risk assessment? You guys, do you guys have any closing comments, Commissioner or Scott?
Thank you for having us today. We appreciate your time.
Scott, would you like to make any closing comments?
I do not. Thank you for having us.
You guys, thank you so much for coming today. Thank you for, we just wanted to just open a conversation with Alaskans. And, of course, we care about the state, you know, and liability and concerns to the state. So thank you for helping answer some of our questions. Many are unanswered, but I think that the discussion is important to have. And we really, really wanted to say thank you. And this, we may continue this discussion, but we really appreciate your time today.
Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Right now? Yeah.
Yeah, just before we move on, because I'm not sure where you're going next, I've been listening to the discussion and, have to put that back up, sorry. And I am just wondering, I know I had concerns with the 241 as far as liabilities, risk, government maybe not realizing it, but essentially picking winners and losers. I'm wondering if we might be able to find out from the courts whether there have been any lawsuits filed in Alaska in regard to risk, liability, or in regard to a a business perhaps feeling like that they were picked on in a way that other business types were not? I think that's important for this committee to know.
I think that is an excellent question, and arbitrary application is very, very important. So, Senator Hughes, I'm going to look into that for a future hearing. So thank you very, very much. And with that, thank you very much. We're almost we just have one more thing on the agenda today. So we are going to go ahead and move on to the confirmation hearing. We looked into it a little bit and wanted to just have a few statements about, there was a letter from Ledge Legal, and I think, Senator Shire, you wanted to talk about that.
I can. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just there was mentioned last week, one of the Judicial Council nominees or appointees, a point was made to about the constitutionality of it. And so not knowing that ourselves and had not heard that, we have a, from our I'm not sure the words we use all the time, unbiased, objective, or nonpartisan, I think is the word, for Ledge Legal. We wanted to get a little more fidelity on that. So just for the record, so we can talk about it, we did ask the question, it was asked, about whether Christy Babcock's appointment violates area representation provision in Article 4, Section 8 of the Alaska Constitution, and if there was any case law on this question. So just, if it, Madam Chair, permission to read. So just for support, so it's for the record, it is my understanding that with Mrs. Babcock and the Judicial Council, all three non-attorney members would be residents of different cities within the same judicial district. Article 4, Section 8 of the Alaska Constitution provides in relevant part that three attorney members of the Judicial Council shall be appointed for six-year terms by the governing body of the organized state bar. Three non-attorney members of the Judicial Council shall be appointed for six-year terms by the governor subject to confirmation by a majority of the members of the legislature in joint session. Appointments shall be made with due consideration to area representation and without regard to political affiliation. There is no case law on the question of whether appointment of all three non-attorney members of the Judicial Council from the same judicial district violates Article 4, Section 8 of the Alaska Constitution. As a matter of first impression, it is always difficult to predict how a court might rule. That was made clear last week when we had Megan Wallace in here. Further, it says, I believe, however, that in the absence of a direct prohibition on the appointment of all three non-attorney members from the same judicial district, that it is more likely that a court would find that the appointments do not violate the constitutional requirement for due consideration to area representation. So just for the balance of it, not trying to disprove, because again, it's legal and it's practice and it's, you know, it's not black and white. We did want to get a legal opinion on it just to see where it sits, and I thought it was important that the committee hear that one, there's no case law, and two, that our Ledge Legal believes that it is more likely that the courts would rule that this appointment does not violate that provision from the governor in this particular case. So just for what it was worth, I wanted to have that on the record to discuss what was brought up last week. Thank you.
Senator Kill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate the note from my colleague. I just refer to some of the recordings of the Constitutional Convention itself, and in discussion by the group, I'm forgetting the name of the committee that was working on the judicial article. Delegate Sundborg actually asked about some slightly different language that talked about the Judicial Council. And he asked what was meant by the phrase on the basis of appropriate area representation. And it was McLaughlin who answered him. He said, the phrase on the basis of appropriate area representation was put in there as a guide in order to assure that the Judicial Council would not consist entirely of three lawyers, let us say from an area like Anchorage. It was intended to have the representation from all areas of the territory. We were indicating an intent to have a geographical representation, to which Sundborg asked, so that refers to and modifies the word appoint on the basis of appropriate area representation. Now, while the language later changed slightly, the report from Style and Drafting, said they had none of their changes altered the intent of what the committee had reported out. So just to be clear about what the intent of the framers were from that committee, and they said it on the record, they specified the lawyer group needed to have representation from all areas of the then territory, now state, and that that intent applied to the appointments. So, I mean, it wouldn't make any sense, and the language does not, in fact, differentiate the lawyer group from the non-lawyer group. It is clearly the intent of the framers of our Constitution that both the lawyer appointees and the non-lawyer appointees be appointed with due regard for area representation. So, again, no aspersions on the appointee, but there would be no judicial council member from the far north of Alaska, and all of the public members would be from a relatively small stretch of very fine communities, but not geographically diverse communities. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Schauer.
Thank you. And to Senator Keel's point, just to be clear, I'm not trying, I don't want this to turn to a counterpoint and a counterpoint. Because it was new to me and had not heard that, we just wanted to put on the record that our, you know, Ledge Legal folks look into this. And it, I believe the words, if I was to go back and read it, it becomes something to like a specific prohibition of doing so. In other words, if it was challenged in court, and I'm not going to try to find it, but that was basically it, that the court would probably find that the governor would not be prevented from doing that, even if it was intent language, as opposed to maybe, in other words, shall and may. You shall do this versus you may do this. So, again, not my lane. I'm not a lawyer. I just wanted it out there that it's something for us to consider so the committee had heard it, that there it would be a question, I suppose, because there is no case law and it hasn't been challenged. Perhaps if this goes through, there will be, and then we'll know. So, again, not to try to set it either direction, only that there is some question as of how this would play out. So I just thought it was important to get it out there. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Okay. Senator Hughes, go ahead.
I just want to comment on that because I find it fascinating. Thank you, Senator Keel, for bringing that to light, because there were many attorneys involved on that committee and in the overall drafting. It's interesting. It's almost like there's a piece missing. There's a gap, because even though they had that discussion and that was the intent at their time, it did not translate into firm language in the Constitution. So I think we might be missing part of the story. Because attorneys typically don't allow for ambiguity like that, and it does say due consideration. In other words, if you consider all the areas, but that you aren't required to appoint from a separate and different areas. So I find it pretty fascinating. I think there's a piece of the story missing. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, and so with that, I'm going to make a brief comment. I don't know if this is going to help you or not, Senator Keel, but she was raised in Anchorage, so she graduated from East with me, but I think you make a valid point. I genuinely do. So I like regional appointees. It has nothing to do, because I think she's a fabulous appointee, no doubt, but I do think you make a valid point, and I think you make a very, you know, valid point too. So, you know, that's why I like being able to let her head on just a little bit in here and have a little bit of open debate amongst us. At least we weren't shut down. At least our voice was heard in here, you know? And I think that's really important. And also, I never want to forget, not a single day that I serve, that we serve the people. We are the legislative branch. We represent the people. And that's why whatever my hearings are in this committee or whatever committee I chair of, I'm always going to put the hearts of the people first. So just so you guys know, that's where my heart is. It's not protecting big government or anything like that. It's the people that we serve that don't have a voice. We have to be their voice. And I tell you, I've never heard in my entire life more Alaskans hurting. And that's why I'm going to use this to be a voice of the people and who you represent, to hear and bring the hurts of what's going on across the state right now. And if there is more, sadly, where are they going to turn to? Who are they going to turn to? So with that, I want to say thank you guys for both getting that on the record. And I think you have a motion, Senator Schauer.
I do. Thank you, Madam Chair. In accordance with AS 39.05.080, the Senate Judiciary Standing Committee reviewed the following and recommends the appointments be forwarded to a joint session for consideration. State Commission for Human Rights, Cynthia Erickson, Tananaw, Betsy Engel, Fairbanks, Alaska Judicial Council, Christy Babcock, Soldotna.
And with that, I'd like to remind members that signing the reports regarding the appointees to the boards and commission in no way reflects the individual's members' approval or disapproval of the appointees. The nominations are merely forwarded to the full legislature for confirmation. We're going to take just about 2 minutes to sign, and then I'm going to do closing comments. gavel back in at 2:37. So with that, basically on Wednesday, February 10th, we have a hearing. We had asked the Department of Law to come. They had basically responded, however, they want us to do the confirmation hearing, and we're like, wait a minute, don't jump ahead of us. We want to talk about the disaster declarations and what role the Department of Law played in the disaster declarations, the extensions, the mandates, et cetera, because I know I had some good conversations with Department of Law, and they put their stamp of approval on it. So that's really important for me to get that on the record, and I'd like to get that separate from the confirmation hearings. We may have to mix it up, you know, when he comes before, but I will be asking these hard questions, but I preferred to keep it separate. But I just wanted to let you guys know that we're still working through the details right now with Department of Law. If Department of Law does not show up, we will fill in the blanks. Like I told you, we were going to have an OSHA person come before us and talk about the masks and basically what they do or do not do, and also a constitutional attorney that talks about the masks. And so anyway, that's very, very important because this is impacting a lot of people's lives every single day, and it's continued to impact people more and more life. I'm not going to be afraid to talk about topics that maybe other people are afraid to talk about. I'm gonna make, because these masks are impacting, I can tell you, so many people that either cannot fly because their special needs kids cannot wear a mask, and so they're now, they can't go see their relatives. It's impacting them in multiple layers. So anyway, we're gonna be having that conversation, and also we're gonna continue on Senate Bill 14, which is the courts Senator Schauer's bill. And we are going to have public testimony on Wednesday, so that's going to be important. And then on Friday, we've invited the courts to discuss Senate Bill 14. They've asked me, I've not met with them yet, but they've asked to come and testify. And also, we're hoping to have a doctor come and talk about an alternative approach than just continually extending these disaster, what a better approach might be. But that's still to be announced. With that, we are going to go ahead and gavel out a little bit early today at 2:39. Thank you, committee members, for your attendance.